All right, I mentioned last week my intention is to wrap up this study on Leviticus today. We've been here, it says 35 weeks, actually I guess the second week we took two on, so, you know, we've been here, you know, a good 36 weeks studying this book and relating it to many aspects of, you know, the rest of the Bible. And so looking back, I spent longer here than I ever intended to begin with, but I'm not apologetic because we talked about so many different things in the process. But when it came to the end here, I thought to myself, well, there's still so much more. And I struggled, and I said, no, we're gonna bring it to an end. We're going to wrap it up. And but it was really difficult trying to figure out how to bring this this study in for a landing, and especially when there is so much more that could be said. But you know, there are other things to learn about. I hope that our appetites have been whetted for this book, and you see some of the beauty of it and how foundational Leviticus is to the rest of Scripture. But what I want to do today is really show us how the things that we've learned about Leviticus, the tabernacle, priesthood, and sacrifices all point us forward ultimately to Christ, and they are fulfilled in Him. And we've talked about this many times along the way, but I want to do it just one more way today, talking particularly about His death. Okay? What I mean is that, you know, we've seen Leviticus shows us the way to approach, you know, way for a sinful man to approach a holy God. And again, we've related, you know, the tabernacle, the priesthood, the sacrifices, all those things to Christ and His work. But the author of Hebrews is the one who especially brings out all these parallels. And unlike some today, you hear a lot of scholars saying, well, unless the New Testament specifically speaks of something in the Old Testament as a type of Christ, we don't have the permission to. And I think that's a completely wrong way to look at things. I believe that the fact that the author of Hebrews, for example, and other gospel the writers can relate all sorts of things to Christ is an invitation to us to do that with much more. Okay? To explore countless other ways that everything is pointing forward to Jesus. But the author of Hebrews, again, is the one who especially does this, showing us the tabernacle, the priesthood, the sacrifices, all those things point to Christ. And he argues that you know, one of the proofs of this is that the Levitical priesthood and system of worship always was a type of a reality which was to come. And the proof of that was the fact that the blood of bulls and goats could never take away sin. That's why they had to be continuously repeated again and again. By contrast, Christ once and for all offers up Himself as a sacrifice for sin. And when that happens, the veil in the temple is torn in two. That old method of approaching God was done away with. The author of Hebrews also talks about how the Levitical priesthood was provisional. He says that that it was to give way to a greater priesthood, the priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek is this curious figure we meet in Genesis 14. Abraham brings to him tithes. And Melchizedek is the priest king of Salem. He combines offices of priest and king. And in Psalm 110, we don't hear a lot about Melchizedek, but Psalm 110 prophesies of the Messiah and David's son who will be king, and says he will be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. So the Messiah is going to combine the roles of priest and king. And his priesthood will be an everlasting priesthood. So all those are indications that the Levitical priesthood is temporary. The author of Hebrews says, Levi paid tithes to Melchizedek in the loins of Abraham. Okay? The Melchizedek priesthood preceded the Levitical priesthood, and it is a perpetual priesthood. And Jesus' priesthood is after that order, which teaches us that Levitical priesthood was always intended to be temporary. Okay? Jesus becomes incarnate then in order to bring that Levitical system to an end. Jesus combines humanity and divinity. He combines heaven and earth, which is what the tabernacle did. You know, the God met Abraham on the mountaintop, which raises up from the earth. It goes up into heaven, just like the Tower of Babel. You know, they built this tower to reach up into heaven. It raises up above the earth, and that's where, you know, heaven and earth intersect. And so the temple is built on, you know, as we saw on Mount Moriah. And so you see this intersecting of heaven and earth. Well, you see it in Jesus' own person. Jesus is God and man. And even the materials in the tabernacle pointed forward to that. You had wood overlaid with gold. And, you know, wood comes from trees, and men are often likened to trees, you know, like planted by the rivers of water, etc. And, you know good men by their fruit. They bear good fruit or, you know, bad fruit, etc. And gold, you know, is associated with God. Gold is heavy. The word glory literally means heavy. And there's a passage in Isaiah where God talks about how he uses Assyria to judge Israel, but then Assyria becomes lifted up with pride, and God says he's going to judge Assyria afterwards. And he says, I will peel back the gold and expose the wood and show you are but man. Okay? That kind of gives us a real indication that even in the materials that are used in the tabernacle, this concept of divinity and humanity coming together in the person of Jesus is so heaven and earth can intersect. You know, it's fulfilled in him. It's for that reason. Jesus is in John 1, he is said to literally tabernacle among us. The word became flesh and dwelt among us. Well, literally, he tabernacled among us. And as Nathanael, when he sees Jesus and an Israelite in whom there's no guile, Jesus says, you will see the angels, you know, ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. Jesus is the gate, the house of God incarnate. He is the fulfillment of Jacob's ladder. So that's why Jesus says, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me. A lot of times today we say, well, we lift up Jesus, we praise him, and that he'll draw all to him. But John tells us he's talking about his death. Jesus is crucified up on a cross, suspended above the earth. You know, that place, the new holy mountain, where heaven and earth intersect. So, you know, all of that's pointing us to Jesus. Jesus is the one who fulfills all the Levitical rituals. He opens up the place for us to go with God. And that's why he tells the disciples in John's gospel. He says, I'm going to a place and you can't go there, you know, but I'm going to come again and I'm going to bring you there. Jesus is the one who goes into the Holy of Holies ahead of us to prepare the way. You remember the high priest would fill up the room with smoke, with this cloud of smoke before entering on the Day of Atonement. So the Bible tells us Jesus ascended in a cloud, you know, when he ascended to the Father's presence. And he does that in order to open the way for us. Okay, so the tabernacle, the priesthood, the sacrifices, all of it comes converging in the person and work of Jesus. He is the one that everything we've been studying, you know, points forward to. And we see this particularly, there's so much more we could say, but we see this particularly by his death. That's where it really all comes together. And I want us to think just briefly here about the ascension offering and what it's pointing forward to. Because the author of Hebrews really shines some light on this, I think. What I mean is this. We saw in the Levitical offerings, the first one that is explained is the ascension offering, or what we call, most of our Bibles call the whole burnt offering. And remember, I argue that's literally an ascension offering. That's Leviticus 1, okay? The altar where the animals were burned up is called the altar of ascension. Because, while there are other offerings, the purification, the cleansing, what happens after that is the animal's transfigured. The animal represents the worshiper. The animal's transfigured and ascends to God's presence, offering tribute and having a meal with God. Okay, there's the idea. And the idea of that most basic of sacrifice is the idea of the consecration of the whole of the individual to God. Okay? That's why the whole animal, we call it, most translations call it the whole burnt offering. Because the whole of the animal is burned up there. There's no portion going to the priest, no portion going to the worshiper and all that. The whole of the animal is consecrated to God. So there's a sense in which that ascension offering, it points us forward to Jesus in his total surrender to the Father's will. If you think about it, we see this really coming clear in the Garden of Gethsemane. Adam was in the garden, and what does he say? God says, don't eat of the fruit. And Adam says, well, not your will, but mine. I'm going to do it. Jesus, by contrast, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, not my will, but yours. Jesus comes to offer himself up, his whole self, even to the point of death, okay, in complete obedience to the Father's will. And in doing so, by his, particularly that supreme act of obedience, the death on the cross, Jesus fulfills and completes that sacrificial system. He replaces that sacrificial system, which only typified what he did, by his life of obedience, which culminates especially in his death. And we see this particularly in Hebrews 10. I'll read verses 8 through 10, where the author of Hebrews is showing how those sacrifices symbolize ultimately obedience. It says, previously saying, sacrifice and offering, burnt offerings and offerings for sin you did not desire, nor had pleasure in them, which are offered according to law. Then he said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God. He takes away the first that he may establish the second. By that we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once and for all. Okay? Jesus has taken away the first. He's taken away the Levitical sacrifices that he may establish the second, which is obedience to God's will. Okay? God, he didn't delight in those sacrifices. What God delights in is obedience. But when, the whole of that animal was offered up to God, that was symbolizing that. Okay? So it's supremely in his death that he fulfills all of these things. And Paul makes this very clear in Romans 5, when he makes a comparison between Adam and Christ. And he says, because of one man's disobedience, many became sinners, and because of one man's obedience, many are made righteous. Most scholars today believe that one man's obedience does not refer to the entire life of Jesus. It presupposes the life of Jesus, but the emphasis is especially on that one act, which was his death. Okay? I'll say that again. In Romans 5, verses 12 to 19, Paul makes a comparison between the first Adam and second Adam. One man's act of disobedience, that eating the forbidden fruit, brought sin in the world. Sin spread to all men, and death followed. Okay? Similarly, by that one man's act of obedience, particularly his death on the cross, then, you know, God's righteousness abounds to many. Jesus' sinless life is presupposed in that Jesus had to be without blemish, right? The sacrifice had to be when the Bible in the Old Testament talks about those like Job who are blameless, that's the exact same word used of the sacrifice that is without blemish. Okay, it's blameless. That's literally what it means. So his life was, you know, one of obedience, but it's particularly that act of obedience that brings an end to the tabernacle, the sacrifices, the priesthood, etc. Okay? And what I want to do today is show you particularly how that's fulfilled in the rending of the veil in the temple that opens up the way to God that, you know, happens when Jesus dies on the cross. Okay? Let me just, before we do that, just open things up. You got a question, anything there? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the blood had to be taken in. I'm not sure if I understand exactly the.
Well, you said one, the ascension offering, the animal right. Consumed in its entirety.
Okay.
And then you went on to say, not like that, where it is burnt and divided up.
Okay.
Priests, etc.
Purification offerings, a priest got a portion of, and peace offerings, the priest and the worshiper and his family all got a portion of.
So the thing that separates the two is that one is ascension and the other is purification. I remember this talk.
Purification comes first. Okay, well, the first one explained is the ascension offering. But in the sequence of covenant renewal, you're purified first. Purification offering is first. And after that, ascension. On top of the ascension is the tribute or grain offering, which is the work of the person's hand. So the person is accepted, their works are accepted. And then the last one in the sequence is a peace offering in which you get to have a meal. And the worshiper and his family and friends, etc., can all come and partake of that meal. So that's what we try to duplicate in our worship every week. We confess our sins. We have the sursum corda, sanctus. We ascend into God's presence. Then we offer up the works of our hands with our tithes and offerings, and then we have a meal with God. So that's what we try to duplicate. It's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, and it just continues in Revelation. If we studied Revelation, we'd see the whole thing as a big worship service following this same pattern. All right, well, let's talk here. So in the back of your first page, let's talk about this rending of the veil here that takes place. The veil is the veil separating the most holy place. You know, only on the Day of Atonement could the priest go in there. But when Jesus dies, that veil is ripped into top to bottom. And we're going to look particularly at Mark's gospel and how that rending of the veil is tied in with Jesus' death, okay, which, you know, shows the Levitical system is obsolete in Christ, okay? First of all, one of the themes, Mark's gospel, on the surface, it appears to be the simplest. It's the shortest, 16 chapters, and Mark spends like chapters 11 to 16 all on one week. So, you know, the last week of Jesus. So he really is in a hurry to get to his death in many respects. Mark is follows the same basic outline as Matthew, just without the big speeches. Matthew gives us five big sermons by Jesus that are all identifiable with this little marker at the end. After Jesus had finished these sayings, you look at Matthew and look at those red blocks if you have a red letter edition of the Bible, and you can see these five big sermons, okay? And Mark is more presenting Jesus as a man of action. The emphasis is on the things that Jesus does, and particularly casting out demons, that sort of thing. And one of the things we see early on is Jesus in his person is taking the place of the temple. We see this by how Jesus is constantly making people, he's cleansing people, cleansing lepers, casting out demons all throughout Mark's gospel. And there's a difference here because the priest's job was mostly one of diagnosing and declaring uncleanness. You came there, he took a look at your skin, you got these white flakes, and he sees flesh underneath. He says, well, you've got leprosy, you can't, you know, you have to go out from the, you know, the community till this, you know, is taken care of, and you come back in, and you can be, you know, we'll go through this ritual, but you know, until this is taken care of, you can't draw near to God. Jesus, by contrast, he's not diagnosing and declaring; he's making people clean. Okay, he's doing what the priest can't do, and remarkably, he does that without himself becoming unclean. Which again is, if you were a Jew and you know in that first century. We think all these stories are kind of neat because somebody touches Jesus and they're made well, and you know when they're unclean and that's not just like saying, oh wow, Jesus is powerful. You know, it's no, this is Jesus is bringing an end to those clean unclean distinctions, all that sort of stuff. We see one of the places where we see Jesus kind of making the Levitical system obsolete is particularly with his encounter with a Gadarene demoniac who's dwelling among the tombs. Okay, a priest would not have gone among the tombs. Remember when Jesus, he critiques the Pharisees for being whitewashed tombs. Well, what that was about, when there was a graveyard, they would whitewash these markers, these grave markers, so that you could see them, so they could stand out, because you wanted to avoid them. You wouldn't want to be walking, you know, someplace and then walk in this graveyard in the middle of the night and you know, come in contact with that uncleanness. Jesus just kind of has a disregard for these unclean places. They don't make him unclean. Okay? He's superior to that Levitical priesthood. And it's very important that, particularly in Mark's gospel, Jesus comes to the temple, he pronounces its judgment, and he walks out of it. The emphasis in Mark's gospel is not on the cleansing as much as it is the declaration of judgment. He walks out, he says the temple's going to be destroyed. Later on, when he's arrested, the centerpiece of the charge against him is that he's going to destroy that temple, and he's going to raise it up. He's going to raise up a new one, made without hands, in 3 days. Okay? Now, interestingly, when Jesus is on the cross, that charge is made against him by the blasphemers who are there. And let's see, I can't. I should have looked this up too. I can't remember if the criminals crucified beside him. If they do likewise. Let's see, or maybe it may just been the passerbys. Yeah, those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, "Aha, you who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross, okay? If you're capable of destroying this temple and building another one in 3 days, then you ought to be able to come down off of this cross, okay? Something that's kind of interesting here is the tense that is employed by the blasphemers. In English, you know, we have past tense, present, future. So in Greek, you have basically punctiliar and linear. You have something that happens at a point in time, or you have something that is ongoing. And what they use is a linear tense of active participles. They're saying, you who are destroying the temple and building it in 3 days. Okay? It's as if, as Jesus is dying, he is then and there destroying the old temple and building the new one. Okay? You are destroying the temple. By his death on the cross, he is destroying the temple. And he is building the new one by his death. Okay? It's not like you're going to. He is. So it seems as if in Mark's gospel, by his death, he is destroying that old temple and building the new one. Okay? Yep. It's kind of like Caiaphas later. He speaks in prophecy. It's better that one man die than that the whole nation should perish. Little does he know that he's stating truth just like Balaam did despite himself. If that makes sense. We don't have confirmation. The tense is, and there's an article the Torn Veil Cultus and Christology that looks at the Torn Veil. That was in the Journal of Biblical Literature that looks into this and the peculiarity of using the active participles to say that you are destroying the temple, you are building a new one. I mean, this is basically what they're saying, not you're going to, etc. You who are doing it, you know? And so there's a peculiarity to it. And when you look at that, by the way, Mark speaks about the torn veil in conjunction to Jesus' death, it seems to be that they're saying more than what they think, if that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to know what all the psychology is and probably a combination of events that happened that day, the darkening, you know, the sky, all that sort of stuff. So it's hard to say, but that may well have been. It's very ironic that, you know, the reason why we're white, this is the last day of ordinary time. This is Transfiguration Sunday. Jesus, you know, he's transfigured and we're reminded again that he is the Son of God. And when, you know, the thing that Jesus was challenged about by Satan was, you know, if you're the Son of God, cast yourself down from the mountain. If you're the Son of God, then, you know, turn the stone into bread, etc. And, you know, this comes right after Jesus' baptism where it's pronounced from heaven, this is my Son in whom I'm well pleased. All right. Well, Jesus is reminded, you know, he is the Son of God on the Mount of Transfiguration right before beginning his journey to go to his death, where the people will be challenging him, if you are the Son of God, you know, bring yourself down from the cross. It's interesting in I think it's John's gospel particularly, you know, which Jesus is crucified on the sixth day, and there's six times, three times they say crucify him, and three times they, I may be getting it wrong here. Three times they say, if you're the Son of God. It's like they deny him six times altogether on that sixth day. I think they're taking the David Chilton brings this out in his commentary. They're taking on that mark of the beast in their rejection of Jesus. Anyway, I'm digressing here. What I want us to see is, I think Jesus' death is the destruction of the temple system, and Jesus, as he's dying on the cross, he's bringing an end to the Levitical system and establishing, you know, his perpetual priesthood. He's bringing that desired end of the Levitical system to its completion, and we see this in Mark's gospel by how he frames Jesus' death around the rending of the veil. Okay? What I mean. One of the trademarks of Mark's gospel is something known as intercalation, or more simply, sandwich stories. A sandwich story is when you begin a story, you interrupt the story with another story, and then you come back to the original story. Okay? So imagine, you know, a piece of meat between two pieces of bread, right? That's why they're called Markan sandwiches. And what they're intended to do when Mark interrupts a story with another related story is they're supposed to mutually interpret. Now, I'll just give you the example in Mark 5. The centurion calls on Jesus to come and heal his daughter who is sick. He proceeds to go to the little girl who's at the point of death, and he's on his way, and while he's on his way, a woman with an issue of blood for 12 years reaches out and touches his garment. She becomes clean. Jesus says, "Who touched me?" You know, he perceived power had gone out from him. And she's made well, and, you know, they have that interchange, okay? Well, then they arrive at the house. Turns out Jesus has come too late. Well, Jesus raises her from the dead. And then Mark tells us, and she's 12 years old, okay? Now, if you look at other gospel writers, you know, they a lot of times they'll do these stories in different orders and so forth. But Mark particularly does one of his famous sandwich stories here, and he links the two together. You got a woman with issue of blood for 12 years and a little girl who's dead, and she's 12 years old. And you're supposed to mutually interpret those things. Okay? And I think the 12 represents, you know, the tribes of Israel. And Israel is unclean. Israel is dead. Jesus has come to cleanse Israel, to raise Israel back to life. It's not just cool stories. Look how powerful Jesus is. Okay? There's a lot more going on there, I think, by the fact, you know, the Spirit presents the story as it does. In the next chapter, Mark tells the story of the beheading of John the Baptist in a different way than the other gospel writers do. He tells us about how Jesus sends out the 12 on a preaching mission, and they go out and they're all, you know, they go out and they're healing people and they're casting out demons. They're doing all this kind of really, they're anointing people, they're healing them, all this cool stuff. And then Mark interrupts it with the beheading of John the Baptist, and then it comes back to them completing their mission, and they're all happy about, you know, hey, look at all these things that we're doing. And of course, the idea is, hey, those who go out on mission for Jesus end up getting killed like John the Baptist, all right? The disciples don't get it yet, okay? So there's lots of Markan sandwich stories. And what I want us to see is that Mark presents the rending of the veil in between two references to Jesus' death and the confession that the centurion makes regarding Jesus' identity. Okay, look on that last page. Anytime, you know, you see duplication of key phrases, that's usually an indication you got a chiastic structure of some sort. And this is Mark 15:37-39. Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. Then the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. So when the centurion who stood opposite him saw that he cried out like this and breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. Now the Spirit didn't have to, you know, have to duplicate those earlier words to draw our attention back to verse 37. Notice how the rending of the veil seems to kind of interrupt Jesus' death and the centurion's confession, which is based on, you know, on Jesus' death. There's several things that are significant about this. Mark's gospel begins by giving us its purpose. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That's how Mark's gospel starts out. This is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Okay? Curiously, though, throughout the book, the only people ever recognize Jesus as the Son of God are demons. The disciples don't get it. The disciples are scratching their head, you know, when he calms the storm. They say, what manner of man is this? Okay? But demons, Jesus cast out demons, and they're like, oh, you're the Son of God. Well, Son of God means king, so every time they do, Jesus says, don't tell anybody. And so the reader is given information that the disciples don't have. And we're supposed to see the irony. It's another trademark of Mark's gospel. There's a lot of irony in it. Okay? We know Jesus' identity, but the only people who ever get it in the gospel is the demons. Even, and it's kind of, it's interesting, you know, in Matthew 16, we have this famous confession that Peter makes. Jesus says, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. In Mark's gospel, that's omitted. He said to them, but who do you say I am? Peter answered and said, you are the Christ. Mark doesn't present Peter as presenting Jesus as the Son of God. Okay? The first human who recognizes Jesus as the Son of God is a pagan soldier of all people at the moment of Jesus' death. Do what? John Wayne in the greatest story. Oh yeah, it was John Wayne. That's right. That's right. Over John Wayne.
But Peter's words, according to Mark, you are the Christ, is not equivalent to you are the Son of God?
Well, the Christ means anointed one. And I think there is an equivalence to it. It's just, I think it's significant that Mark doesn't list that.
Yeah.
That he doesn't include that. Okay? Because Mark has a different purpose. That's why, you know, sometimes people will see these contradictions in the text, you know. Well, you know, one gospel says, you know, this is Jesus, King of the Jews, and another gospel writer has less, another has more. You know, when you have, there's two women at the, you know, two angels at the tomb, another says one angel. Well, where you have two, you have one also. Sometimes a gospel writer will tell us more, some will tell us less. Just as each of us, if we were telling a story, we would all do different. There's no contradiction, in any of this. They each tell the story from their perspective because they're trying to make a particular point. Okay? Let me just kind of read this number 4 and 5 here, and here's what we're getting at. In summary, the rending of the temple veil signifies the entire dissolution of the Levitical system by demonstrating that the new way to God has been opened by Jesus' death on the cross. This is especially seen by the manner in which Mark inserts the rent veil as a commentary on the centurion's experience. In particular, it must be noted that the centurion does not see the rending of the veil. Okay? The rending of the veil is taking place there in the temple. Okay? He's what I believe on the Mount of Olives. All right? There's no way he can see that rending of the veil. All right? Rather, he stands facing Jesus and responds particularly to Jesus' death. And yet, Mark inserts the rending of the veil as a commentary on the centurion's experience in order to help the reader interpret Jesus' death as an end to the Levitical system. Jesus, in summary, is the Son of God who again enters into God's presence on the holy mountain. Okay? You remember, Adam was the Son of God, according to Luke 3:38. Michael Morales says this, Mark's literary strategy exhibits Jesus' death as serving to remove the veil that hides the face of God. As he dies, God shows his face, and the centurion finds himself standing on holy ground. Here are the culminating themes of Jesus' rejection unto death, the disclosure of his identity as the Son of God, and his displacement of the Levitical cult all coalesce into a grand epiphany. In dying, Jesus removes the veil from the face of God, and it is his own face, a revelation that is the undoing of Jerusalem's temple. The temple is the dwelling place of God, and therefore the place to meet with God. It holds the vision of God as the place where one may behold his face. Remember that that bread is face bread, okay? That show bread. And we remember our benediction at the end each week, you know, his face, the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face shine upon you, be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his face upon you. We say countenance upon you and give you peace. That's literally what Hebrews says. So it is the way to God to this beatific vision through the sacrificial cultus.
Beatific,
there we go. The temple harmonizes the glory of perfection beholding God and the suffering that is the way to that glory through sacrifice and the shedding of blood. This is what the temple is for, and Jesus' death fulfills these functions. His crucifixion opens the way to God and is itself the revelation of the face of God. Okay? Jesus' death on the cross fulfills the Levitical tabernacle, priesthood, sacrifices, and that rending of the veil is you know, the sign that all this stuff is done away with. I've mentioned to you, I think it's very significant to note that, you see the replacement of the holy place and all that, particularly then in the Easter scenes when the disciples come to the tomb, which is located in a garden, and the stone is rolled away, and they look inside the slab where Jesus' body had laid, and there at the head and the foot are two angels, just like those angels at the Ark of the Covenant. And there's the linen cloth lying there. The linen cloth is the cloth that the high priest puts on when he goes into the holy place on the Day of Atonement. And then he takes it off and leaves it behind in a holy place before going out and appearing to the people to let them know the sacrifice has been accepted. And it's interesting that Peter and John run to the tomb and John hesitates to go in. Peter comes rushing in. I've mentioned to you, I think John was a priest. Besides being a fisherman, he was a priest. All indications are that's the tradition the church says. And I think that, that explained his hesitancy initially. That veil's ripped in two. Now the way into the holy place is made open through Jesus. All this stuff just comes converging in him and his finished work. And let me just add, the fact it was a Gentile that recognizes Jesus' identity as the Son of God, I'll just read this, demonstrates the new temple made without hands will indeed be a house of prayer for all nations. And when we get to Revelation 21 and 22, where we read about the New Jerusalem, it says, and the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory and honor into it, and they shall see his face. Okay? That's what it's pointing forward to, and it all finds its fulfillment there. And we could spend weeks more talking about the New Jerusalem and all that stuff, but at some point we got to bring this to an end. So I hope I'm trying to bring this to a landing here. Yeah.
It's not a problem with thinking this, but I have this correlation going in my head. So, the curtain is rent, so that was technically when the whole system was brought to an end, but then it was, probably approximately about 4 years later before the temple was actually destroyed. So that makes me think about, in the Exodus, they're brought through the Red Sea, so they're technically, they're delivered at that point because Pharaoh is no longer chasing them, so deliverance has been completed, but then they have to wander around in the desert for 40 years before, and so it seems like there's some kind of bookend to that,
I'm certain Jesus was crucified in AD 30. The only two dates anybody ever debates is 30 or 33. I think Paul makes that very clear in Galatians. That he says, I was converted after 3 years. I went to Jerusalem after 14 years. I went up again by revelation. We know that he's talking about his famine relief visit in Acts 11, which is in AD 44. So that puts us back to AD 30. Jesus, the temple's destroyed in AD 70. I think that 40-year parallel is on purpose. N.T. Wright calls that a wrinkle in time in which the old order is passing away, the new one is beginning. And that's why Paul in 1 Corinthians 10, he talks about the wilderness generation. He says, all these things are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Paul's saying all that stuff that happened back there with Israel and its deliverance, the wandering in the wilderness for 40 years before entering into the promised land is parallel to that New Testament time in those 40 years in which our ultimate deliverance occurs in AD 30, but there's a 40 years of transition before the kingdom comes in its fullness. And that what was symbolized by that veil being torn in two, I think, is definitely done manifest for all to see. Who could have seen the rending of the veil other than the priest inside the holy place? But everybody could see that temple destroy and showing God's finished with that sacrificial system. Yeah. So what was done typologically is done.
So you don't think there's any aspect of
I will say this. I don't know all the parallels, but one of the big issues in the New Testament, particularly in Hebrews, but you see it in Peter and James, there is this threat of going back. Just like the Jews wanted to go back to Egypt, that the whole argument in Hebrews is you don't want to go back to something that's obsolete, something that was only typical of the reality which was to come. Because for a lot of those Christians, especially the Jewish Christians, many of them were tempted. They were thinking, well, we made a mistake here becoming Christians. Life got real hard. And they were going to have to come through this travail. So, it's referred to, many times like as a childbirth. There was that tribulation, you're going to have to endure some pain before this new world was birthed, basically. And Jesus goes through it, in Gethsemane, and then the church goes through it. The head goes through it, then the body goes through it, too. And when AD 70 occurs and that temple's gone, and Jew and Gentile distinctions, they were gone forever. All those Jewish records, the tribal inheritance, all those things are destroyed in the city. When it was burned. So, that was like, that's why AD 70 is such a big deal, and it's not realized. I've mentioned to y'all before, one of my reasons, N.T. Wright, he sees the significance of it. He sees it everywhere and recognizes that so much of what we think is second coming into the world was AD 70. That was a big deal. That was the thing that put that stamp on who Jesus was, really. or one of the things, you know, the spirit, that pouring in the spirit was the first, perhaps. If that makes sense. Yes, sir.
It's really interesting, the topic, especially the centurion being the one to recognize that Jesus was the Son of God first, reminding me of the movie Prison that came out last Easter. I don't know if everybody saw it, but it basically tells the story, not of that particular centurion, but of a different centurion who is investigating the allegations of Jesus' resurrection, and then eventually became a Christian once he saw what was happening. Very reminiscent.
I haven't seen it. I've heard that it's well done. I haven't seen it.
Three times. Well, okay.
Okay.
Just
risen. Joseph Fiennes plays the guy. He's the same fellow that played Luther in the Luther movie done a few years ago. Okay. Yes, sir. First Peter, Second Peter, James, Hebrews, especially those letters written near the end. I mean, they're all written to suffering Christians, you know, and they're being encouraged. People use different tactics, but they're all being encouraged. Hang in there. Persevere. Don't turn back. And that's the huge issue in Galatians. I mean, those Judaizers, you know, I said last week, I think it was last week, that the big issue was eschatology. You know this? You don't go back to circumcision. That's done away with. And God's building this new temple made of people. Okay. Let me mention to y'all before we close this. You want to chant once?
Sure.
Completely up. This is up to you, right?
Okay.
How do you want to do? Okay. I started this study, and I have a lot of different resources. A lot of lectures, commentaries. There's a commentary on Leviticus by Gordon Wenham. Very, very well written. Wenham is, I love his approach. He says, okay, this is what it meant by man. This is how it pointed to Christ. This is what it means to us today. And he would do this for these sections. And like I said, I had a lot of lectures that Jordan and Lighthart had done on Leviticus, and a lot of different articles. But this book had, it's by Michael Morales, called Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord? It's a biblical theology of the book of Leviticus. It came out about 2 years ago. And R.C. Sproul Jr., he does his like review of books that he read the previous year. And I guess the year before, he said this was his top book of that previous year. And so all of the Biblical Horizons guys, you know, kind of checked this out. And a couple guys read it and said, you all got to read it. And, you know, so I did. And then Peter Lighthart did. I was ahead of him one time in my life. Okay, that's because he was writing 10 books. But you know, he made a blog about this and said, if you want to study Leviticus, this would be the place to start. And this is a magnificent book. It's a little. It looks more intimidating than what it is. The bibliography, I think, is I don't know. It's 50 something pages or whatever. So it's not quite as lengthy. This is accessible. You do have to take your time. It's dense, but man, there's so much more that he brings out about this journey to the temple, going up the mountain, you know, going through the waters up the mountain and stuff. If you want to learn more about the tabernacle, temple, the sacrifices, all that sort of stuff,
This is one of those books that are just, you know, every page is just a wonderful, insightful, you know, tour de force or whatever. A lot of books you read and you get a little something out of them, or, you know, you try to weed through and say, well, I appreciate this about it, but I disagree with that. And that's just a marvelous book, really is. It was a huge, huge source, resource for me. And he didn't go into the details of the sacrifices, those sort of things, the way we did. Other places I had to rely on other books, but man, that is a, you want to reinforce some of the things that we've learned, I cannot recommend that book highly enough.